Sometimes it strikes me that the Christian liturgical year is a little funny. It was just a couple of weeks ago, it was December, we were talking about Advent. We were waiting for the birth of the Christ child. And for 4 weeks, we were talking about waiting. We lit candles here. And then on Christmas, there was the celebration of the birth of the Christ. And now here it is only 6 weeks later. And all of a sudden it's Lent, and it's time to prepare for the death and resurrection of Christ. And I know that the liturgical year happens that way because calendars are calendars, and there's all kinds of historical reasons why it's that way, but sometimes it seems a little jarring as people when we show up to church. And so today we're here, and I'm inviting us to contemplate repentance today. And that may not have been what was on your mind this morning when you woke up. Maybe you're more in a mood for waiting now. Maybe you're still in an Advent kind of mode, and I'm pushing you into a Lenten kind of mode. But I wanted to take a moment to step back and look at what Lent means, and to look at what this notion of this kind of scary old-fashioned word called repentance means. Lent is traditionally the 40 days preceding Easter. It starts with Ash Wednesday, and it ends on Easter. And traditionally, back in the early centuries of Christianity, it was a time when the people who were preparing to join the Christian church, which meant they were preparing to be baptized into the Christian church, it was a time of them for them to do their own spiritual preparation in order to purify themselves in order to be baptized. And over the years, things changed in the churches a little bit, but it traditionally remained a time of prayer, of almsgiving, meaning giving money to charity, of fasting. And I know we're all familiar with the concept of people giving up things for Lent. That really comes from the original practice of simply fasting for all or part of Lent. There's another piece of the traditional Lenten practice which has been practiced to greater or less degree in some traditions, and that is the practice of self-examination, meaning that it's a time to look inside ourselves and to look at what's there, to examine what is serving our growth and what may not be serving our growth. In the New Testament, the Greek word that is usually translated as repentance is metanoia, and that word literally means to think differently after. It also reminds us of the word conversion. The Latin word root for conversion is conversio. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. Conversio, which means to turn. So conversion literally means a turning, which is similar to repentance, which means to think differently after, to go through some sort of change. Now, the reason that repentance has such a scary connotation is partly due to different people who've preached it over the years. I came across some definition that John Calvin used many centuries ago. John Calvin said there were three aspects of repentance. One was the transformation of the soul as well as the external aspects of a person. The second aspect was that repentance must come from a serious fear of God, that people would not change unless they were coerced by fear of divine judgment. And the third aspect was that it consisted of mortification of the flesh and vivification of the spirit, meaning that the physical body would need to be punished and subsumed so that the spirit could come forward. Now, in the Swedenborgian Church, I would take some of those ideas with us. The notion of external actions being in line with our internal self, and the notion that of giving more life to the spirit. But I think some of these other ideas about being afraid of divine judgment and mortifying the flesh are ones that we have set aside. And I was reminded that in Swedenborg's writings, he talked about having visions where he argued with John Calvin in heaven. I was remembering why he probably did that. Emanuel Swedenborg, to my knowledge, didn't give any particular attention to the liturgical season of Lent, but he did give a lot of attention to the concept of repentance. As you may know, one of the most distinctive things about Swedenborg is that he believes that the whole purpose of our lives was to go through a process of spiritual growth and discovery. So that Lent, we might say the tradition of Lent, is just putting a highlight or a lens on what Swedenborg said can be happening all the time in our lives, which is the process of regeneration, the lifelong continuing process of growing from being primarily self-centered, occupied with oneself, and unconscious about our greater actions, to being primarily centered in love, love of God and love for others, and being more self-aware. But this process happens in a general sense over the course of our lives, and it also happens in all kinds of small ways, little things that might come up on a daily basis or a weekly basis. So it's happening in different cycles and different dimensions all through our life periods, if we're open to it, if we choose it. It's also about, the regeneration process is ultimately about opening ourselves up to love so that we can create a bigger space within ourselves to receive love and to give love. And also opening up more of a space so that our internal self can be in harmony with our external self. So that our actions in the world are in line with our values, our beliefs, and our faiths. And so that ultimately we are all in line with the highest source, which is God, and our actions flowing out from us into the world, all in line with what is deepest and true, which comes from God. So how does regeneration happen? It sounds good, it sounds easy maybe, but we know it's not always so easy. Swedenborg described the process of regeneration a couple of different ways. One way is having three distinct stages. First stage is repentance, the second stage is reformation, and the third is regeneration. So repentance is that first stage, when we wake up and we become conscious that there's a better way we could be doing something. It's a time when we tell the truth to ourselves in one way or another. We become honest with ourselves and we see that there is a bigger world, a bigger set of values by which we want to live our lives. A new consciousness dawns, we might say. Something happens to expand our sense of our own consciousness and expand our sense of what we want in life. Sometimes the stimulus comes from within. Sometimes it comes from outside of ourselves. And you know, we've heard stories of people going through some kind of trauma in their lives, an accident or the death of a loved one, which spurs them on to growth, to wanting to live in a new way. And sometimes the stimulus can be within us. Sometimes we get to the point where we have put up with our unhealthy habits for too long and we cross some line and we realize we have to change. For Emanuel Swedenborg, the 7 days of creation that are described in the book of Genesis, and we read the description of the fourth day, but for Swedenborg, all 7 days symbolize the process of spiritual regeneration within a person. And I won't take you through all the steps, all the details of the 7 days, but it's basically a process of becoming conscious is the first stage. Becoming conscious of who we are and who God is. Becoming conscious of goodness and evil. And becoming conscious of wanting to change. And then beginning to change, opening up a space for God's light and love to come in. Practicing the new behavior, and then eventually letting it in so much that it becomes like second nature, and that our lives are ultimately guided by God. And in a sense, what this means is that we get out of the way enough that God can more easily work through us work through us and in us. Now, the interesting thing about this process, too, is that we all have a knowledge of what goodness and health feels like. That's the whole reason why it's possible in the first place, is that somehow we're born with an innate knowledge of what health is. And Swedenborg called that concept remains, which is another old-fashioned term. But we can just think of it as in terms of having an innate knowledge of what is good. So in our theological tradition, we don't talk so much about salvation necessarily like they do in some other traditions. Salvation in our tradition is actually comes from this process of regeneration. It's not a process that is forced upon us by someone else. It's not God reaching down and grabbing hold of us. It's not feeling that we have been saved or forgiven even by Christ's death. That's a theory called vicarious atonement. What we believe more so is that there is always a possibility for spiritual growth and change. God is present at all times, everywhere. And what is possible to change is that turning. It's within us because we all have the freedom to perceive and to make a change. So again, that sense of metanoia, to think differently after, that comes from our free will. It's also a sense of needing to clear the ground, in a sense, before we can plant a new garden. If you imagine a garden that's filled with thorns and filled with briars, we have to clear it out before we can plant the good stuff. There was a passage I read from Swedenborg where he gave all these colorful examples, and that was one. And he also said if we wanted to start a new city, a just government, we'd have to throw out all the criminals first. And if we wanted to worship in a church, you can't worship in a church that has corpses under the floor. It was a sense of clearing the decks and starting fresh for something new. So I think that in this sense, for me personally, this concept of repentance, which at first seemed like an old-fashioned, scary word, I think there's a way to reclaim it, to start thinking about it in a way that invites a softer sense of self-examination. I came across a quote from Father Thomas Keating, a Catholic priest who started the Centering Prayer Movement, and he talks about this process of self-examination being a kind of divine therapy. And that Lent is a time when we can actually focus intentionally on doing that divine therapy to become conscious of our unconscious dynamics and how we are sometimes governed by them, and then how we can intentionally set them aside. So that's enough theology for one morning. I want to tell you a story now. It's a story about a woman named Margaret. She was a 44-year-old woman. She was married. She had two children, a 6-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. And she worked as a fitness instructor, and her husband was an attorney. And they had a nice life. They had a nice house, and their children went to private schools, and their children were always very polite and very well-groomed. And it seemed like she had a good marriage, too. It seemed like a lot of things were really good. But there was one difficulty, which was that Margaret had a lot of trouble controlling her anger. She felt a lot of anger on a daily basis. It was sort of a constant thing that she carried around with her and always tried to keep under control. And sometimes it would flare up, and sometimes she would keep it under control. And often when it flared up, it would do so on her children. She would end up expressing it on her children. She ran a very tight schedule in her day. She was always on the move, always wanting to get things done, get through the day. And so she was always rushing her children and wanting them to, you know, get up, get dressed, let's go, you know, that sort of thing. So she was very impatient, and she would get really frustrated when things didn't move along as she wished. She would command her kids and scold them sometimes, and sometimes there was this edge to her voice, this edge that sounded like rage. And other people would notice it from time to time, that if there was something in her voice that didn't quite sound right. Margaret had a friend named Tracy, and Tracy had noticed this behavior over the years, but had tried to just chalk it up to, you know, different personalities, different parenting types. But as time went on, Tracy began to be a little uncomfortable with how Margaret was speaking to her children. And she decided that she needed to say something to her about it. She wanted to bring it to Margaret's attention a little bit more. So they were out to lunch one day, and Tracy asked her about it. She said she knew that she'd had some, she'd been struggling with her anger and just wanted to ask, check in, how was it going? You might imagine Margaret was shocked. She was really taken aback. And she said, well, everything's fine. Why do you ask? And so Tracy said a little bit more, you know, expressed a little bit more of her concern. And Margaret became very upset. She was humiliated. She was angry. She was ashamed. And she started crying. And she almost got up from the table and just, you know, walked away. But she didn't. She stayed at the table. And what happened next was really interesting. Margaret admitted that every night when she went to bed, she reviewed the day in her head, and she evaluated whether she had been good or bad, or how bad she had been. She would take stock of how many times she had yelled at her daughter, whether she had insulted her, whether she'd taken it too far, whether she'd crossed the line. She was consumed with guilt because she loved her daughter and she wanted to do the right thing. But she couldn't seem to get out of this cycle, this vicious cycle. It would also happen with her husband and her son. She would be so angry at herself, so ashamed of her behavior, so filled with guilt that she would vow to just stop. She was just never going to get angry again. She was never going to raise her voice again. And she'd have a few better days, and then it would slide into it again, and it would start happening again. She admitted that she knew that it was wrong, but in some sort of twisted way, she felt like she could get away with it. She felt that her family could take it because they weren't calling her on it. They never stopped her, and nothing major ever happened to really make her change. But that conversation with her friend was a wake-up call. It was a wake-up call. And so the next weeks and months after that were really a turning point for Margaret. At first, she was still angry with her friend for confronting her that way and humiliating her in a sense. But at the same time, she could see the truth in it. And if there was a truth in it that she recognized she wanted to follow. She knew that she did need to make some big changes in her life. And she realized that it was time and that she needed to do it by going inward. In the weeks afterwards, she began to talk with Tracy more about her childhood, about her own childhood. And she talked about how she'd grown up with a father who was alcoholic and how crazy it was to live that way, not knowing when he was going to come home or what kind of mood he was going to be in when he came home. She talked about how he would yell at her sometimes and how uncertain and destabilizing it was to live in a household like that. So what came out over time is that Margaret became conscious of the fact that with her current life, with her children, she was still fighting the demons from her past. The pain of her own childhood had cast a sort of mold that she was still acting out of. She hadn't been able to set that old mold aside, even though those things and those people weren't actually present in her life anymore. She was still responding to them. She wanted to control everything so much so that she could have a sense of security. And she was angry at her kids, perhaps because those were the voices she had in her head from how people spoke to her when she was a child, or maybe because in some sense she was, her children's relative ease in life reminded her of how much she had missed out on as a child herself. So through this process of inward reflection, of telling the truth, and reaching out, Margaret began a process of healing. She began a journey toward healing her past, toward grieving what she had lost, centering herself more in love, and improving her relationships with her family. And the way it all started was with that old-fashioned word, repentance. I don't think Margaret was a religious person. She probably didn't ever think of that word. But that's what it was. She looked inside of herself, and she told the truth about what was going on. And she reached out to grow toward better health. It's an adventurous path towards self-discovery and healing. It takes a lot of courage. Now, what's interesting to me about this story is that the conversation with her friend simply uncovered something that was already there within Margaret. In actuality, the friend didn't have to even say very much before all of this stuff just flooded out. It was almost as if Margaret was waiting for someone to just flip that switch so that she could reach out toward that healing and connection. And that's what I was saying earlier about remain. There's this sense that we all know exactly what healing feels like. That's already within us. And the process of repentance or Lent is looking within to get in touch with that core sense of wholeness. And then we can begin to perceive what might be going on within us or around us that might be preventing that powerful sense of wholeness and love and life from living as it wants to live. I know that within each of us there is this powerful life force wanting to burst forth, like the daffodils that we see blooming outside right now. There's just something coming out of that wet, cold earth that just blooms forward with this bright yellow flowers. That's what's inside of us too, the sense of love, freedom, trust, being fundamentally okay with the world, living in community with other people. That is our destiny. So the process of repentance, and what I invite you to do this Lenten season, is to take some time in prayer. Take some time for self-examination. Take some time to feel that life force, that ebullient, vibrant life force that knows exactly what health feels like. To feel that within yourself. And then to notice, if you can, what hindrances there might be to that force really coming out and living. And lift those up in prayer as well, in honest and courageous prayer. There's something magical and mysterious about the process of becoming conscious of things. They seem to somehow shift just by naming them. So I invite you this Lenten season into that mysterious process, that your hearts may be open, that a space may be made very wide and very clear for God's love and healing and hope to flow through you and out of you and into the world.